Hi, this is Ted, and for the next hour, you'll be listening to a reading of the Monday, September 8th, New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Start out with an article from the front page. Trump's name is on projects he opposed, by Richard Fawcett. In southern Connecticut, the federal government is replacing a 118-year-old bridge along America's busiest rail corridor. The $1.3 billion project was largely funded by the 2021 infrastructure law that was championed by then-President Joseph R. Biden Jr. and strenuously opposed by Donald Trump. These days, however, motorists cruising by the construction site might be forgiven for thinking that a certain famous New York developer was responsible for it all. It says, in bold letters, President Donald J. Trump, rebuilding America's infrastructure. In recent months, a number of similar signs have popped up in front of major infrastructure projects financed by the bipartisan 2021 legislation, a $1.2 trillion package that Trump, who left office in January of that year, had passionately railed against. He called the bill a loser for the USA and warned that Republican lawmakers who signed on could be thrown out of office by angry primary voters. Patriots will never forget, he wrote. The signs bearing Trump's name now adorn bridge projects in Connecticut and Maryland, rail yard improvement projects in Seattle, Boston, and Philadelphia, and the replacement of a tunnel on Amtrak's route between Baltimore and Washington, according to W. Kyle Anderson, a spokesman. For the company. In an email, Mr. Anderson said the new signs are a voluntary Amtrak initiative updating outdated signage posted at the project locations listed previously following the change in presidential administrations earlier this year. The signs note in a smaller font that the projects in question are funded by the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the official name of the legislation that Trump tried to derail. Still, the signs in bold MAGA red strike some as misleading. Representative Joe Courtney, a Connecticut Democrat who represents the area where the Connecticut River Bridge is being replaced, said seeing the sign with Trump's name there is just, you know, very odd to me. He added, that bridge would never have gotten where it is today without that bill, which he opposed. It is hardly unheard of for a new administration to replace signage featuring the name of the previous president, but the 2021 infrastructure law has uncorked particularly intense debates over the granting of credit, perhaps inevitable given the size of a spending package that was roughly the size of the gross domestic product of the Netherlands. Last year, in the midst of election season, Politico compiled a list of a number of House Republicans who voted against the bill, but went on to take credit for bringing projects funded by the legislation to their districts. Representative Nancy Mace, who is currently running for governor in her home state of South Carolina, called the bill a socialist wish list, but she didn't protest the millions of dollars it allocated to public transit upgrades in the Charleston area. What do you want me to do, turn my back on the low country when we get funding for public transit, she said, when asked about the apparent contradiction, according to a local newspaper. A number of infrastructure projects formerly featured signs name-checking Mr. Biden and Mr. Anderson, the Amtrak spokesman. Project funded by President Joe Biden, infrastructure law, some of them stated. Those true, too, drew backlash. In June 2024, Senator Ted Cruz complained about them to the Office of Special Counsel, arguing that they amounted to campaign signs for Mr. Biden and thus violated the Hatch Act, which limits federal employees' political activities. Those displays are nothing more than campaign yard signs courtesy of the American taxpayer, the Texas Republican wrote at the time. The Special Counsel's office investigated the matter and disagreed with Mr. Cruz and closed the case. This week, Mr. Cruz's office did not respond to an email asking whether the Trump signs might also violate the Hatch Act. Infrastructure questions are sensitive for Trump, who ran for president in 2016, asserting to voters that he was one of the nation's great master builders, promising an infrastructure rebuilding program to rival the New Deal area. But he never quite pulled it off. In fact, his administration's repeated efforts to hold an infrastructure week became a running joke during his tumultuous first term. In April, 3 months after Trump began his second term, the Federal Railroad Administration stripped language from its grant agreements that had required signs about projects made possible by the 2021 legislation to say they were funded by President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure laws. The Connecticut Department of Transportation took this as a signal to remove signs with Mr. Biden's name, said Josh Morgan, a department spokesman. The replacement of the Connecticut River Bridge, which connects the towns of Old Lyme and Old Saybrook, is expected to generate up to 300 jobs. According to Mr. Courtney, the existing bridge was found to be structurally deficient in 2006. Trains must now slow down to 45 miles per hour to cross, he said. They will be able to cross the new bridge at 70 miles per hour. At the dawn of the second Trump administration, Amtrak had good reason to worry about its future. In March, when Elon Musk was deeply involved in slashing federal government programs, the billionaire said that the company was embarrassing and should be privatized. Representative Pramila Jayapal is a Democrat whose Seattle district includes a rail yard project where some of the signs were put up. She speculated that Amtrak may have posted them to remain in Trump's good graces. Look, I think that what we're seeing is Trump demanding loyalty from every single government agency, she said. Whether or not that is the case, Amtrak appears to be on a more secure footing in the early months of the Trump administration. Sean Jeans Gale, vice president of policy for the Rail Passengers Association, an advocacy group that seeks to improve passenger rail service, said that after the scare of Mr. Musk's call for privatization, the administration ended up releasing a presidential budget for passenger rail that is very measured and allows Amtrak to keep running the trains and make some key investments. Asked about the signs, a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Transportation said in a statement that Amtrak was recognizing the Trump administration's swift action in clearing a backlog of roughly 3,200 grants that the Biden administration had allocated but not awarded. The process had been sped along, the statement said, by cutting unnecessary DEI and climate mandates from the grant process. Amtrak news releases show that construction on some projects featuring the Trump signs began in the Biden era, including the Connecticut Bridge project and the $2.7 billion replacement of the Susquehanna River Bridge in Havre de Grace, Maryland. Mr. Anderson, the Amtrak spokesman, praised the Transportation Department's hard work, which he said had helped address the backlog. He added, "We appreciate the Trump administration's strong support for Amtrak's historic infrastructure investments." Here's a health article. Doctor berated for claim tying vaccines to cancer by Stephen Castle. This is in England. A British cardiologist suggested, without evidence on Saturday, that COVID-19 vaccines might have been a factor in the cancer suffered by members of the British royal family, drawing swift condemnation from the government, health experts, and cancer support groups. The cardiologist, Dr. Asim Malhotra, made the claim during a 20-minute speech at the annual conference of Reform UK, the anti-immigration party led by Nigel Farage, which distanced itself from his remarks after they provoked an outcry. Speaking from the main stage at the party's two-day event, Dr. Malhotra said on Saturday that he had been told by a professor of oncology that he thinks it's highly likely that the COVID vaccines have been a factor, a significant factor, in the cancer of members of the royal family. The British government quickly denounced the claim as dangerous to public health. "When we are seeing falling numbers of parents getting their children vaccinated, and a resurgence of disease we had previously eradicated, it is shocking, irresponsible for Nigel Farage to give a platform to these poisonous lies, the Health Secretary Wes Streeting said. Farage should apologize and sever all ties with this dangerous extremism. Health charities also attacked the comments. There is no good evidence of a link between the COVID-19 vaccine and cancer risk, the group Cancer Research said. The vaccine is a safe and effective way to protect against the infection and prevent serious symptoms. Later on Saturday, Mr. Farage's party distanced itself from Dr. Malhotra's comments without criticizing him directly. Dr. Asim Malhotra is a guest speaker with his own opinions who has an advisory role in the United States government, the party said. Reform UK does not endorse what he said, but it does believe in free speech. King Charles III announced in February 2024 that he had received a diagnosis for an undisclosed form of cancer, but he resumed royal duties in May that year and has attended many high-profile events since then. And in March 2024, Catherine, Princess of Wales, announced a cancer diagnosis in a pre-recorded video broadcast. She, too, has since resumed public duties. Buckingham Palace declined to comment on the doctor's remarks. During his speech, Dr. Malhotra said that he was advising Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the U.S. Health Secretary, adding that they were in frequent contact. Dr. Malhotra is the chief medical advisor at the Make America Healthy Again Action Advocacy Group, but he is not listed among U.S. administration officials. The oncologist Dr. Malhotra said he had spoken to, Angus Dalglish, is a professor of oncology at St. George's University of London, who has also spoken skeptically about COVID-19 vaccines. Neither Professor Dalglish nor the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services immediately responded to requests for comment. Although it is generally recognized that in a small percentage of people, vaccines have produced some side effects, the idea that they can promote or accelerate cancer is not supported by mainstream medical experts. Skepticism toward vaccines has increased in many countries in recent years, despite decades of research supporting their overall safety. In the United States, Mr. Kennedy has long expressed doubts about vaccines, including those against polio and measles, the mainstay of childhood immunization for decades. He has also described a plan to, quote, make America healthy again, a phrase that Mr. Malhotra adapted during his presentation, make Britain healthy again, on the final day of the conference. The party led by Mr. Farage, who made his name by campaigning successfully for Brexit, has only 4 lawmakers in the British Parliament, but it leads comfortably in opinion polls after a series of missteps by the government of Prime Minister Keir Starmer. During his speech, Mr. Malhotra called for a moratorium on mRNA vaccines to review their safety, which were developed and rapidly deployed during the pandemic. He argued that most drugs were developed in order to generate money for pharmaceutical companies, and he also criticized the World Health Organization. Last month, the U.S. Health Secretary canceled nearly $500 million of grants and contracts for developing mRNA vaccines, which were rapidly created during the COVID-19 pandemic by Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna. The mRNA shots instruct the body to produce a fragment of a virus, which then sets off the body's immune response. And you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Another disturbing health article. This is called, quotation marks, "Something is wrong with my brain." And the subtitle is, "The cause of a police officer's descent became clear only after his death," by Sonia Rao. Gina Elliott's phone buzzed with a text message from a friend. It was a link to a news article about the gunman who opened fire in a Midtown Manhattan office building in late July, killing 4 people and then himself. He had left a note in his wallet that said he believed he had a chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, the degenerative brain disease linked to repeated hits to the head that has been found in hundreds of deceased football players and can be diagnosed only after death. "Study my brain, please," the note said. It was an unsettling echo from Ms. Elliott, whose husband Brent Simpson, a police officer in Charlotte, North Carolina, died by suicide last year. In the months before his death, he repeated to her daily, "Something is wrong with my brain." Ms. Elliott and Mr. Simpson had been together almost 20 years and had known each other even longer, but the man she lived with in the last few years of his life was not the same man she met in 2001. "It's like he became a different person," she said, "like somebody I didn't know." Mr. Simpson started as a patrol officer at the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department in 2006, working the night shift. In 2011, he moved to the police academy as an instructor, teaching defensive tactics, and he helped train multiple classes of 40 to 60 recruits each year. The most intense part was called Red Man Training, named after the brand of gear that instructors or volunteer officers wear in fights with recruits. Mr. Simpson wore headgear and padding, but would nonetheless return home looking tired and beat up, Ms. Elliott said. Often there were not enough volunteers, so Mr. Simpson would have to spar with many recruits. Red Man Training happened 4 to 6 times a year, but there were other drills that required physical contact. "I was very concerned about getting a concussion or getting injured because of the amount of shaking or hitting," Shannon Finnis, a former officer with the department, said of her academy training. "I can only imagine what kind of toll that would take on somebody over time." A spokesperson for the department declined to comment on Mr. Simpson's career or whether any blows sustained as a defensive tactics instructor might have contributed to his cognitive decline. Ms. Elliott started to notice small changes in Mr. Simpson in 2020 when he was 43. He lost interest in his hobbies and described having foggy memories. By then, he had moved on from his role at the police academy and was a canine officer. His woodworking tools gathered dust in the garage. He wanted to stop training for his black belt in jiu-jitsu. He told Ms. Elliott he would retire early, even though it had been his longtime dream to work in a canine unit. "You finally got the job you love, but you want to leave? Why?" she remembers asking. He didn't have an answer. When a friend died and Mr. Simpson was asked to speak at the funeral, he paused. "I'm having trouble remembering things from my childhood," he told Ms. Elliott. "I don't know whether what I'm remembering is real or imagined." She began to keep a journal, diligently noting when he uncharacteristically broke into tears, told her he could not feel joy, or complained of an intense pressure in the right side of his head. In January 2023, Mr. Simpson saw a psychologist who persuaded him to attend a month-long inpatient rehab focused on mental health treatment for law enforcement and first responders. He was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and therapy was recommended. His problems worsened. For the last 18 months of his life, Mr. Simpson could not sleep more than 3 hours a night. Nothing helped, not the over-the-counter medications he took at first or the Ambien he was prescribed later. He became suspicious of neighbors he did not recognize. He stockpiled water and food for a coming doomsday. After work, he would sit on the couch for hours, staring at the wall. Well, that was a little heavy. Here's a lighter story. Krispy Kreme, we'll read about donuts. Krispy Kreme is betting on big box stores to stay fresh. At a factory in the Bronx, making a Krispy Kreme donut involves precision timing. First, flour, yeast, water, and other ingredients are mixed for 14 minutes. After the dough is pushed through a machine that forms donut rings, the rings rise for 35 minutes. Then it's 110 seconds in an oil fryer and a trip through a 55-degree cooling tunnel. But because no one wants a stale donut, time is also the enemy. Last week's limited edition Harry Potter-themed sweets, which were decorated by hand as they rolled off the conveyor belt at 2 p.m., were packed in boxes and picked up within 12 hours for early morning deliveries to retailers like Costco and Walmart. This is the pace the company needs to keep so the donuts don't go stale. Everything is a race. The clock is also ticking for Krispy Kreme executives. They're under pressure to convince Wall Street analysts and investors that their latest plan will turn the company's fortunes around. It's a tall order. The company is making a concentrated push to get its donuts into even more big box retailers, as well as convenience and grocery stores around the country. In the U.S., just to give an example, we're in less than a third of the footprint of Walmart. And so, you know, there are thousands of locations for us to go after, said the chief executive of Krispy Kreme, Josh Charlesworth. The past three decades have been a roller coaster ride for the Charlotte, North Carolina company, aiming to keep investors on a sugar high as it works out how to expand while remaining true to its heritage of serving fresh donuts. While I turn the page here, I could go for a fresh donut. Okay. Yet its shares have plunged 66% in the last year and currently trade around $3.60, a little more than the cost of a chocolate-iced, cream-filled donut in New York City. The company's stock is one of the largest shorts in the market, meaning many investors are betting it could fall even further. Revenue for the quarter ending in June slipped 13.4%. The company said it had lost $441 million compared with a loss of $5 million in the same quarter last year. The drop was largely because of an accounting charge of $407 million, reflecting the falling value of the chain. Krispy Kreme's stock has been a major disappointment since its initial public offering in 2021, JP Morgan analysts said in a note to investors in May. While the analysts said they expected the company to survive, they added that it was difficult to suggest that investors should buy now. Krispy Kreme is trying to regain its traction at a tricky time. Competitors are everywhere, from large players like Dunkin' and Canada's Tim Hortons to regional chains with fervent fans like Duck Donuts from North Carolina, Randy's in California, and Donut Plant in New York. Even Japan's cult favorite, I'm Donut? opened its first store in Times Square this year. But those pastry manufacturers are battling over a shrinking market. After 2 years of food inflation, consumers are cutting back on purchases, and Krispy Kreme donuts can be a pricey sweet. At an Acme market in New Jersey, a box of a dozen original glazed Krispy Kreme donuts costs $15.99. A dozen mixed variety donuts purchased at the company's Times Square location were $28. Whew. Consumers are also increasingly embracing wellness trends, while others are on GLP-1s or medications that curb their desire to snack on sweet or salty foods. This year, J.M. Smucker has taken $2 billion in write-downs on its $5.6 billion acquisition in 2023 of Hostess Brands, which makes baked snacks like Twinkies, Donettes, and Ding Dongs because of falling sales. Mr. Charlesworth said there had been a drop in consumer spending, but he maintained that obesity drugs and wellness trends had not affected the business. This is still a growth story, he said. We faced some challenges and made interventions, but this is a growth story. Mr. Charlesworth was a longtime Mars executive who joined the company in 2017 and was tapped as chief executive and president in January 2024. The previous chief executive of Krispy Kreme, Michael Tattersfield, now heads up the salad chain, Salad and Go. From a simple storefront in Winston-Salem, North Carolina in 1937, Krispy Kreme became a recognized Southern brand even before it established a presence in other places. Customers would stand in line, sometimes for hours, lured by the 1950s diner style and signs reading, "Hot Donuts Now." Once inside, they could watch the donut-making process and at the end snag a piping hot cloud of sugar and yeast that had just rolled off a conveyor belt. "There was this whole theatrical staging of the donut production," said Bonnie Miller, a professor who teaches a food history class at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. "It wasn't just seeing the donuts being made, it was smelling them. Mm-hmm. The sensation that they were fresh, warm off the production line, that was key to Krispy Kreme as a brand." In the 1990s, the company went on a national expansion plan as its popularity soared, referred to in shows like Sex and the City. In the midst of the booming tech bubble of 2000, Krispy Kreme was one of the hottest public offerings of the year, and its stock continued to rise over the next 3 years. In 2003, a Fortune magazine cover declared Krispy Kreme's the hottest brand in America. Just 2 years later, however, the brand was ice cold. A sharp decline in sales pushed some franchisees into bankruptcy. A regulatory investigation forced Krispy Kreme to restate 2004 earnings because of accounting irregularities. Top executives were ousted. Amid growing losses and lawsuits, the company's stock plunged from a high of nearly $50 in 2003 to below $5 by 2005. In 2016, the company was acquired and taken private by JAB Holding, a European investment firm, for $1.35 billion. After a few years were spent putting the company in firmer footing, Krispy Kreme went public again in 2021. But the stock's performance has been less than dazzling, losing 81% of its value over the last 4 years. Earlier this year, the company pinned its hopes on a partnership with McDonald's. A program put the donuts in 2,400 McDonald's restaurants, and Krispy Kreme's executives told Wall Street analysts and investors in February that its donuts would be in 6,000 McDonald's restaurants by the end of this year. Instead, the partnership ended in June. For Krispy Kreme, the volume fell off more quickly or meaningfully than they had expected, and part of the reason was that some of the marketing they had initially, some of the support from McDonald's, seemed to peter out a little bit, said Sarah Senatore, an analyst at Bank of America. They invested heavily ahead of the McDonald's arrangement, and now they have to unwind that. For Krispy Kreme, the cost of unwinding that relationship was high. In early August, the company took about $30 million in various impairment and termination costs related to the McDonald's partnership. On top of that, it said after completing an impairment test that the fair value of the chain itself had fallen more than $356 million. Once again, Krispy Kreme executives are trying to regain the company's momentum. To reduce expenses and lower debt levels, the company plans to sell its international businesses in Britain, Ireland, Australia, and elsewhere to franchisees. The company, which had been managing its own fleet of trucks to deliver its donuts, is transitioning to third-party logistics firms to oversee deliveries. "It's one thing to manage three or four trucks," Mr. Charlesworth said, "but as the fleet expanded, it became too complex. After all, we're the donut people." These days, Krispy Kreme is focusing largely on getting more of its donuts on store shelves of retailers like Costco, Kroger, and Walmart. While there is concern among some Wall Street analysts that the brand is diluting itself by making its donuts too readily available in stores in the U.S. and international markets, Mr. Charlesworth said there were plenty of locations where customers could not obtain a donut. "When we ask consumers who have not purchased a Krispy Kreme, the top response on the list is, 'I can't get them.' The availability has long been the number one barrier to purchase." Well, that wasn't more cheerful, but it wasn't about people dying. You're listening to a reading of articles and features on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Station, Radio Reading Service. And you can probably You can probably tell that I'm really thinking about donuts. Okay. Here's an article about AI, which is kind of interesting. This is an editorial, actually, by Gary Marcus, who is the founder of two AI companies and the author of 6 books on natural and artificial intelligence. And it's called "The Fever Dream of Imminent Superintelligence is Finally Breaking." GPT-5, OpenAI's latest artificial intelligence system, was supposed to be a game changer. The culmination of billions of dollars of investment and nearly 3 years of work. Sam Altman, the company's chief executive, implied that GPT-5 could be tantamount to artificial general intelligence, or AGI, artificial intelligence that is as smart and as flexible as any human expert. Instead, as I have written, the model fell short. Within hours of its release, critics found all kinds of baffling errors. It failed some simple math questions, couldn't count reliably, and sometimes provided absurd answers to old riddles. Like its predecessors, the AI model still hallucinates, though at a lower rate, and is plagued by questions around its reliability. Although some people have been impressed, few saw it as a quantum leap, and nobody believed it was AGI. Many users asked for the old model back. GPT-5 is a step forward, but nowhere near the AI revolution many had expected. That's bad news for the companies and investors who placed substantial bets on the technology, and it demands a rethink of government policies and investments that were built on wildly overinflated expectations. The current strategy of merely making AI bigger is deeply flawed, scientifically, economically, and politically. Many things, from regulation to research strategy, must be rethought. One of the keys to this may be training and developing AI in ways inspired by the cognitive sciences. Fundamentally, people like Mr. Altman, the Anthropic chief executive Dario Amodei, and countless other tech leaders and investors had put far too much faith into a speculative and unproven hypothesis called scaling. The idea that training AI models on ever more data and using ever more hardware would eventually lead to AGI, or even a superintelligence that surpasses humans. However, as I warned in a 2022 essay, Deep Learning is Hitting a Wall, so-called scaling laws aren't physical laws of the universe like gravity, but rather hypotheses based on historical trends. Large language models, which power systems like GPT-5, are nothing more than souped-up statistical regurgitation machines, so they will continue to stumble into problems around truth, hallucinations, and reasoning. Scaling would not bring us to the holy grail of AGI, that is, artificial general intelligence. Many in the tech industry were hostile to my predictions. Mr. Altman ridiculed me as a mediocre deep learning skeptic, and last year claimed there is no wall. Elon Musk shared a meme lampooning my essay. It now seems I was right. Adding more data to large language models, which are trained to produce text by learning from vast databases of human text, helps them improve only to a degree. Even significantly scaled, they still don't fully understand the concepts they are exposed to, which is why they sometimes botch answers or generate ridiculously incorrect drawings. Scaling worked for a while. Previous generations of GPT models made impressive advancements compared with their predecessors. But luck started to run out over the past year. Musk's AI system, Grok 4, released in July, had 100 times as much training as Grok 2 had, but it was only moderately better. Meta's Jumbo Llama 4 model, much larger than its predecessor, was mostly also viewed as a failure. As many now see, GPT-5 shows decisively that scaling has lost steam. The chances of AGI's arrival by 2027 now seems remote. The government has let AI companies lead a charmed life with almost zero regulation. Now it ought to enact legislation that addresses costs and harms unfairly offloaded onto the public, from misinformation to deep fakes. AI stop content, slop content, cybercrime, copyright infringement, mental health, and energy usage. Moreover, governments and investors should strongly support research investments outside of scaling. The cognitive sciences, including psychology, child development, philosophy of mind, and linguistics, teach us that intelligence is about more than mere statistical mimicry and suggest three promising ideas for developing an artificial intelligence that is reliable enough to be trustworthy, with a much richer intelligence. First, humans are constantly building and maintaining internal models of the world, or the world models, of the people and objects around them and how things work. For example, when you read a novel, you develop a kind of mental database for who each character is and what he or she represents. This might include characters' occupations, their relationships to one another, their motivations and goals, and so on. In a fantasy or science fiction novel, a world model might even include new physical laws. Many of generative AI's shortcomings can be traced back to failures to extract proper world models from their training data. This explains why the latest large language models, for example, are unable to fully grasp how chess works. As a result, they have a tendency to make illegal moves no matter how many games they've been trained on. We need systems that don't just mimic human language. We need systems that understand the world so that they can reason about it in a deeper way. Focusing on how to build a new generation of AI systems centered on world models should be a central focus of research. Google DeepMind and Fei-Fei Li's World Labs are taking steps in this direction. Second, the field of machine learning, which has powered large language models, likes to task AI systems to learn absolutely everything from scratch by scraping data from the internet with nothing built in. But as cognitive scientists like Steven Pinker, Elizabeth Spelke, and me have emphasized, the human mind is born with some core knowledge of the world that sets us up to grasp more complex concepts. Building in basic concepts like time, space, and causality might allow systems to better organize the data they encounter into richer starting points, potentially leading to richer outcomes. Versus AI's work on physical and perceptual understanding in video games is one step in this direction. Finally, the current paradigm takes a kind of one-size-fits-all approach by relying on a single cognitive mechanism, the large language model, to solve everything. But we know the human mind uses many different tools for many different kinds of problems. For example, the renowned psychologist Daniel Kahneman suggests that humans utilize one system of thought, which is quick, reflexive, and automatic, and driven largely by the statistics of experience, but is superficial and prone to blunders, along with a second system that is driven more by abstract reasoning and deliberative thinking, but is slow and laborious. Large language models, which are a bit like the first system, try to do everything with a single statistical approach, but they wind up being unreliable as a result. We need a new approach, closer to what Mr. Kahneman described. This may come in the form of neurosymbolic AI, which bridges statistically driven neural networks from which large language models are drawn, and some older ideas from symbolic AI. Symbolic AI is more abstract and deliberative by nature. It processes information by taking cues from logic, algebra, and computer programming. I have long advocated a marriage of these two traditions. Increasingly, we are seeing companies like Amazon and Google DeepMind take such a hybrid approach. By the end of the decade, neurosymbolic AI may well eclipse pure scaling. Large language models have had their uses, especially for coding, writing, and brainstorming, in which humans are still directly involved. But no matter how large we have made them, they have never been worthy of our trust. Excuse me. To build AI that we can genuinely trust and to have a shot at AGI, we must move on from the trappings of scaling. We need new ideas. A return to the cognitive sciences might well be the next logical stage in the journey. And another editorial by David French, whom I obviously like, that says, "Don't let Trump expand the definition of war." President Trump has done it again. He is attacking a genuine and serious problem recklessly, heedless of the consequences, and in this case, of human life. On Tuesday, I watched Trump proudly display grainy footage of a military strike on what he said was a boat full of narco-terrorists on their way to the United States with a load of drugs. Typically, when the Coast Guard or another branch of the military or law enforcement spots a boat suspected of carrying drugs, we seek to stop the boat, search it, seize any drugs, and arrest and question the crew. If these drug-smuggling suspects open fire, American forces can respond, but they cannot simply execute someone on the mere suspicion of drug trafficking. We do not kill those suspected of being criminals from afar or from the air. In the United States, we have two firewalls against unjust and unlawful wars. First, the Constitution grants Congress the exclusive power to declare war. The president does have authority as commander-in-chief to respond to immediate military threats, like an armed attack, but he is not supposed to initiate new hostilities in the absence of congressional action. A crime is not an act of war. It can't be compared to Pearl Harbor, September 11th, or any other attack on American citizens or troops, or allied citizens or troops. To even mention Tren de Aragua in the same breath as Al-Qaeda, much less Imperial Japan, illustrates the absurdity of the administration's argument. Second, the international law of armed conflict still applies to the United States, and that means that presidents don't have the power to order violations of the laws of armed conflict. So where did Trump find the legal authority to initiate deadly force against suspected members of a drug gang? The closest thing we've heard to an actual legal argument is the assertion that Trump could order a strike on Tren de Aragua because it's a designated terrorist organization. Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, argued that American forces may strike anyone trafficking in those waters who we know is a designated narco-terrorist. We knew exactly who was in that boat, he added, and we knew exactly what they were doing, and we knew exactly who they represented, and that was Tren de Aragua. Though I question his certainty, I've had enough experience with airstrikes to know that our intelligence is rarely that precise. Even if he's correct, then that knowledge granted American forces probable cause to stop and search the boat for evidence of a crime, not grounds to execute the crew or any passengers from above. For his part, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, said that the United States will blow up members of criminal groups and on Thursday designated two more groups, the Ecuadorian gangs Los Lobos and Los Troneros, as terror organizations. It is true that the administration has the authority to designate foreign entities as terrorist organizations. The administration has used its authority to classify a host of drug gangs as terrorist organizations. But the relevant statute that allows the administration to make that designation does not include an authorization for military force. What we are left with is a military strike conducted against suspects without due process in the absence of any need for immediate self-defense. The boat was not firing on American forces. Without any congressional authorization, and without any basis in international law. The consequences of Trump's action are terrible to contemplate. If you are in a state of war with a terror organization, then military forces have the right to shoot members of that organization wherever they are found. When I served in Iraq, if we had sufficient reason to believe a person or a group of people were terrorists, we didn't have to arrest them. We could kill them. Brief pause. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As an Army lawyer, I helped my commander make life or death decisions, including whether to use deadly force on the basis of partial information and drone footage. I know firsthand that the process is imprecise, potentially fraught with mistakes, and justifiable only in extreme circumstances. In Iraq, we were engaged in a congressionally authorized counterinsurgency campaign against the deadliest terrorists on earth. Those conditions don't apply to Trump's campaign in the Caribbean. Under the Trump administration's reasoning, the president's power to use deadly force isn't limited to speedboats in international waters. War, after all, is war, and it can be fought wherever the enemy is present. That means members of the National Guard patrolling American streets could be granted broad authority to use deadly force, circumventing due process through a hail of gunfire. Trump has long fantasized about the promiscuous use of military force. His former Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, said that Trump asked about using military force against protesters in 2020 during his first term. "Can't you just shoot them in the leg or something?" Trump asked, according to Esper. Trump also repeatedly asked about shooting migrants in the legs, and he deployed thousands of soldiers to the southern border. And it's not just the president. Republican governors have called the flood of immigrants across the southern border an invasion and sought to unlock their own war powers to respond to illegal immigrants. The laws of war exist because decent societies place a high value on human life and because the world has repeatedly endured the horrendous consequences of total war. Due process exists because millenniums of experience with arbitrary power teach us that rulers cannot be trusted to dispense unilateral justice. Drug trafficking, like all serious crimes, imposes tremendous costs. Drug overdoses have imposed a staggering toll on American communities and families. But to say that drug trafficking is a serious crime with serious consequences is not the same thing as saying that it's an act of war. Conflating crime with war obviously risks inflicting violence and injustice on the innocent and the guilty alike. But there are other risks as well. Military strikes raise the possibility of military escalation. Venezuelan fighter jets flew over an American destroyer after the strikes on the suspected drug boat. And now the U.S. is deploying even more military assets to the Caribbean, including F-35 fighters, our most advanced combat aircraft. Injustice and escalation aren't the only consequences of Trump's foolishness and lawlessness. Perhaps the most dangerous consequence is diversion. Russia and China are moving closer, and China held a military parade last week that showcased an extraordinary range of new advanced weapons. Trump is diverting the military from its primary mission, deterring a war with hostile forces that are infinitely more dangerous than any South American drug gang. No one should have any illusions that either Congress or the Supreme Court will stop the president. The Republican Congress does whatever Trump demands, and the Supreme Court has been reluctant to interfere with the president's authority to use force abroad, especially since the Vietnam War. It's up to the American people to hold Trump accountable for his lawless acts. Every person who pumped his fist at Trump's news conference should pause and think very hard about letting him, or any president, expand the definition of war until due process dies, blotted out by the flame and smoke of a missile strike. And I like, when possible, to end with a letter to the editor. And this is a really good one. The New York Times last week ran an article called "Disney Used to Be for Everyone, Not Anymore." And it described the ways that visits to the Disney resorts have become so expensive that they're out of reach for many, many people. And here's a letter that's signed by Abigail Disney. You'll hear who she is. In regard to Disney's used to be for everyone, not anymore, I would like to say I am Abigail Disney, and my grandfather, Roy Disney, and my great uncle, Walt Disney, founded the company and its famed theme parks. I read Mr. Curl's essay with a mixture of recognition and sadness. Back when the parks were created, they were deliberately affordable. Both Roy and Walt believed that magic could and should be accessible, that joy shouldn't come with a luxury price tag. Mr. Curl outlines the disheartening fact that the ultra-wealthy have become the primary customer base for the ultimate Disney experience. But Disney is not the only place that has lost interest in the middle class. Catering to the wealthy has become a guiding principle for nearly everything. On July 4th, President Trump signed into law a spending bill that cuts social services for everyday Americans, roughly $1 trillion in Medicaid cuts, excluding millions of children from the child tax credit and imposing major reductions for SNAP, while giving even more tax breaks to the wealthy. As someone with a high net worth, I should pay my fair share of taxes so everyone can have affordable and accessible health care and other services. Without a thriving middle class, neither Disney nor any other corporation can continue to function well for long. Accessibility and affordability aren't minor concerns. They should be guiding principles in a country that claims to be free and equal. I thought that was a good letter. Well, this is Ted, and you've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Again, I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed doing the reading, and I will see you next week. Have a good week. Bye.